I am so privileged to be here this week with all of you. I'm, again, Katie Benjamin. I'm a graduate student at Duke Divinity School, and I study the European Reformations out there. So it is mostly just fun to be a Lutheran among Lutherans again. I'm usually a Lutheran among Methodists, which is fine. It's absolutely fine. But they, of course, that sentence was going to resolve in a but. You know, there are just some interesting different theological ideas about, for example, sanctification and how one becomes holy. And the Wesleys just thought when you got holy, you got nice. So they don't know quite what to do with Luther as somebody who had strong opinions on things like the Book of Esther, as you may have heard this morning. So anyway, that's who I am. And without further ado, let's start thinking about our topics for this week. If you can find Psalms, you can find Esther. It's just Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs. So find the big book of Psalms and start leafing backwards a little bit. Esther is a book that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, which is part of why I wanted to explore it with you all, just being contrary and interested in things that get ignored. But people have come up with lots of good reasons, actually, to go ahead and ignore Esther. And the basic catalog is, as you heard this morning, it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention the name of God. It's never quoted in the New Testament. It doesn't seem to have a promise of the church, much less Christ, to come. It doesn't mention basic Old Testament doctrines like covenants and the Torah and purity and eating laws and ceremonial laws, hardly at all. So it's sort of a strange beast stuck into the Old Testament. Luther only really let it in because we had a Hebrew original. He rejected lots of other things that gave him trouble because all we had was the Greek. So he let Esther slip by, but he almost thought better of it. So, on the other hand, a reason to look at Esther, maybe, because it has been a book privileged to be in the canon, in the Hebrew scriptures, and in the Protestant Old Testament scriptures, in the Septuagint, the Greek scriptures, in the Vulgate, in the Catholic scriptures, maybe it's spoken to enough people over enough times and places that we can let it speak to us too. And maybe we just don't get everything at first glance. If there's anything I've learned from the time I've been privileged to spend at Holden, it's that lots of people do see God in nature. Lots of people do. And you hear about it at matins a lot, which is fine. But some don't. Some look at the world and don't necessarily see God at work on the surface of things. In fact, the Hebrew word for world, olam, it's just an ayin, a lamed, and a mem. If you switch the vowels around, you get the root of that word for world. You get alam, which means to conceal or to hide. It's this idea that God is actually hidden from our sight, being in the world. And so you get humorous and heartbreaking observations, such as Douglas Adams, who said, "In the beginning, the universe was created. This made a lot of people very angry and has been widely regarded as a bad idea." We don't necessarily understand everything at first glance. But, and this is why I think that quote from Douglas Adams in the great masterpiece Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a good one, we might suspect. We might not see everything at first, but we might suspect that indeed the universe was created. And bad idea or not, there's a method to that madness. This is going to proceed as a pretty general, run-of-the-mill text study insofar as we're going to go through the text. And I'm going to say stuff as stuff has raised itself in my research that I thought was interesting. But it's also going to be a little bit of conversation, and I've chosen a theme for each day to sort of go with the chunk of Esther that we'll be looking at. And as you may have guessed, either from reading the, you know, sort of summary that I put on the program schedule, or just listening to my rambling introduction, the theme for today is going to be God hidden and revealed in the world. So as we look at the text of Esther, as we begin to get our heads around this story that's told in 10 brief chapters in the Old Testament, we're going to be thinking about, and I'm going to be inviting you to reflect on, the idea of, you know, the characters in the story, or the characters in our story, I mean us, and I mean people we meet in the world, who don't necessarily see God at work, but might suspect, and how Esther can be a sort of, well, not that I would necessarily say, you know, well, have you read Esther, to a person who doesn't see God at work in the world, but can begin to give us some resources to sort of understand that point of view, where a person like that might be coming from. So chapter 1, verse 1. I would love it if we could fall into a rhythm where I say, okay, could somebody read chapter 1, verse 1 to whatever, and someone would just do that. And it's not pulling teeth or anything like that. If it does become pulling teeth, I'll look at people who have books open and point. But let's just go ahead and start easy with just one verse. If somebody could read nice and loud for us. Esther chapter 1, verse 1.
This happened in the days of Ahasuerus, the same Ahasuerus who ruled over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia.
There we go. I have no idea how to pronounce that name either. I think it's Ahasuerosh is how it's spelled in the Hebrew, and we've sort of, nobody needs to do that. Nobody needs to do that.
In the Message, they call it Xerxes.
Yeah. Yes, in the NIV, they do. They use Xerxes. And this is actually our first problem with the text.
We
got one verse in, and I'm ready to give up. We don't really know who this person was with any real specificity. I mean, there aren't enough clues for us to be able to say it's this person without a doubt. This is a common name. It could act, and it's spelled so funny. It could be Xerxes, or it could be Artaxerxes. And of course, there was Xerxes the first and second, and Artaxerxes the first and second. So it's really sort of difficult, and there have been various sort of confident and less confident attributions. But the reason, really, I call it a problem is because what it really raises for us is the question not just of, well, who was this person, but do we actually need to identify? Do we need to line this story up with historical events and an emperor, a Persian emperor, that we can point to and say he had this wife, and then he took this other wife, and there was this, all of this conflict that evolved from there, and it happened in these years? It's the question of whether Esther is story or history, which can certainly strike people as a very, very important question with a book in the Bible that seems to present itself as a historical narrative. And so to resolve that question, I'm going to deflect your attention with something clever, which is a phrase I really like in Polish. Similar to this emperor's name, I can't pronounce it, and I can't really spell it for you, but I can translate it. There's a traditional Polish saying that goes, "Not my circus, not my monkey." And it just means, this is not my problem. You know, monkeys are problems. They come from circuses. I don't have either of those. And I don't have a more familiar phrase might be, I don't have a dog in this fight. To me, a story like this, a book like Esther, it's in the Bible. It has spoken to generations of the people of God. And that's enough for me. So that's sort of where I'm going to start.
It's very clever.
I'm distracted. I mean, just as long as we're on this verse and not wondering too hard who this person is, although I will tell you most of the resources come down on a guy named Xerxes the First, who would have reigned from, well, I wrote it down somewhere, like 486 BCE, before the Common Era or before Christ, to 465. So you could take that if you like. Herodotus, a Greek historian, knows stuff about him and knew his wife's name. It wasn't Vashti and it wasn't Esther, so there's that. But we sort of think, and a lot of modern scholars think that if this corresponds to something historical, it was that guy who didn't have anything like this happen in his life. As long as we're on this first verse, the first words of Esther, who read? Was Penny? Was that you?
I did. Yeah.
And how did your translation start? What I mean, just the first, the once upon a time phrase. What is it?
This happened in the days of.
Yeah. That's what I've got in the New Revised Standard Version as well. The Hebrew behind that is just the word vayehi, and it was, and it came to pass. The rabbis will tell you though that that's a very loaded statement. I mean, kind of in the same way that in English, once upon a time means it's going to be a great story. You know, it's going to be a fairy tale, and we're going to feel good and meet characters and heroes and princesses and things. Vayehi sort of introduces tragedy at the outset. You know, this is going to be a hard story, and it came to pass. This is what starts the flood narrative in Genesis. This is what starts Ruth's story, which in the first chapter is terribly heartbreaking. So we're set up for good feelings. And the last thing before I move on, so this emperor had 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. This is another thing that we don't know what the author's talking about. Persia never had 127 provinces. Xerxes I had about 20. And why are they calling them provinces and not satraps, satrapies, which is the more traditional word? It's funny. But there's a great story that Rabbi Akiva told to his students, because they were drowsy already in the lecture. So I'm going to tell it to you. And he basically cut himself off from the topic of the day and said, why were there 127 provinces in Esther that the emperor ruled over? And then he answered himself like any good rabbi would. It's because Sarah lived 127 years. And she lived perfect and sinless years. And every minute was a town, and every hour was a farm, and of course, her descendant, because Sarah wasted no time, would come to rule. Esther would come to rule over 127 provinces. The fullness of Sarah's perfect life became her descendants' kingdom. That'll make your students sit up and not waste their time in class. I like that story. This has been a fun study to research and prepare. And prepare. Let's try verse 2. if somebody can read chapter 1 from verses 2 to 4 for us.
In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in the citadel of Susa in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his officials and ministers. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were present, while he displayed the great wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days in all.
Our first hint that this is a comedy is this 180-day party. Who was taking care of the empire? who was running the shop while everybody was out drinking? And another, just another interesting note in this picture that we're getting, the emperor has this party of ridiculous length in the third year of his reign, and If Ahasuerus, or however you say it, is Xerxes the First, then he's sort of miscounted, we think, or the rabbis think, if he's counting forward from Jeremiah's prophecy that Israel would be in exile 70 years. If we're in the third year of his reign, he's only gotten to 67. This is a moment when they say, the commentaries say, that there's a premature celebration. Ahasuerus might suspect that he should let these 70 years elapse in case something bad could happen to him, like what happens to another king whose name I can barely pronounce, Belshazzar, in Daniel chapter 5, who has a party and drinks out of the sacred vessels that were plundered from the temple, and ends up, you know, well, there's writing on the wall, that's that story, saying that his kingdom is shortly going to come to an end. He's been measured and weighed and found wanting. And that story doesn't end well for that king. And so the idea is Ahasuerus is waiting for this prophecy to elapse, and he hasn't quite gotten there. He hasn't quite waited enough time, which again sort of sets us up for tension in the narrative, but gives us that image that I'm sort of inviting us to explore in these chapters, of a world that doesn't necessarily acknowledge the power of the true God, this emperor is not a Jew, but suspects that there's a list he doesn't want to be on of people who didn't respect the prophecies and partied too early, which the rabbis then say he did anyway because he miscounted. But we will see what becomes of this emperor. Okay, verses, not just verse 5, actually, if somebody could read.
When these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in the citadel of Susa, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace.
All the people present in the citadel of Susa. Our first question about, again, whether the Old Testament, the other parts of the Old Testament, the Torah, the ceremonial laws, play a role here. Do all the people present include the Jews, who are certainly in this empire, in this city, because, well, we'll get to that chapter. But do they come to the party? Do they actually consume food that's supposed to be off limits to them and drink things that are supposed to be off limits to them? Could this be a sort of underlying, and this is why, via he, and this is why it came to pass, and this is why there was a problem? It's not really obvious from the text, but it could be an explanation for, again, the mounting tension that's going to happen in this story. Verse 6.
There were white cotton curtains on blue hangings tied with cords of fine linen and purple silver rings, and marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and colored stones.
Well, that sounds gorgeous. Do those colors and materials echo anything for good biblically literate folk like you are? I don't think there's a specific passage that it's echoing. But I hear
royalty for sure.
Wealth. Royalty and wealth for sure. Yeah, that's certainly what he's demonstrating. I hear a bit in these curtains and hangings and rings the tabernacle, and in these precious stones and the gold and silver, those apocalyptic descriptions of the heavenly city. Again, this is not directly parallel to any of those passages, but these materials do sort of appear there. I mean, the pavement is precious stones. He's either really extravagant, this person, this emperor, or we're getting a subtle nod that every now and that this person has set himself up to take the place of God, of the emperor of the universe, of the king of the universe. And in fact, not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, the author might be sort of nodding to an allegory of sorts here, where again, the world that we recognize conceals a narrative of the true world, where there is an eternal king on the throne. And one of the reasons that's just an interesting thing to toy around with, again, the name of God doesn't appear in this text, unless you're reading the Greek, but that's because the Greek is longer and goes into some other things. But what does appear in the text, if you're sort of unrolling an ornate traditional Hebrew scroll, is that every time the word king comes up, melech, it begins a column and it's decorated. It's like saying, you know, melech is the point of this story, the king. And melech olam, the king of the world, is an important title for the God of the Israelite people. So again, suggestions of more than what meets the eye going on here.
Did I hear you right? You said that in the Greek, somebody inserted God into
yes.
the text.
Yes.
In the Hebrew, God is not inserted in the text.
That's right. That's right. And
why do they do that? Or are we giving
it? We may well have a chance to discuss that. But as you bring it up, I mean, I think it's interesting and I'm easily distracted. So, I mean, it seems like throughout Esther's history, there's sort of been attempts to read God into the narrative. And decorating the word king every time it comes up in the Hebrew seems to be a sort of attempt to do that. And it's hard to say, I mean, textual criticism and finding what comes first, what comes second is not my circus, not my monkey. But if the Greek is sort of a later expansion on the Hebrew, which all of these interpolations and additions do kind of suggest, then it could be one of those instances of, I mean, the great phrase to look at, I think we'll get to it in chapter 6, I should know this, but there's a dramatic turn of events when the king can't sleep. And in the Hebrew, that's all it really says, is sleep was taken from the king. But in the Greek, it says the Lord took sleep from the king. It's a much more specific claim, and God is there. The Lord took that sleep from the king. Other Greek additions that you can find flipping through your Apocrypha, probably if you have a Bible that has one, there are prayers that Esther and Mordecai, who we haven't met yet, but we will, our heroes actually pray to God, which they're not seen to do in the text that we've got in front of us in the Hebrew. There's a fast that they both engage in, but even that, they don't say we will fast and pray to God or something like that. They just say they're going to fast. In the Greek, there's actually direct address of prayer to God that's recorded. So it's a very interesting and contrast. And one of the ways to understand that is, again, sort of an apology for this silly book that doesn't have the name of God in it and doesn't seem to have much to do with what's going on in the rest of the Old Testament. Fair question. Where did I leave off? We're on verse 7, right? Oh, golly. let's do verses 7 through 12.
Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal white wine, or the royal wine, was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Drinking was by flagons, without restraint, for the king had given orders to all that the officials at his palace to do as each one desired. Furthermore, Queen Vishita gave a banquet for the women in the place palace of King Ahasuerus.
Go ahead to verse 12, if you
okay.
don't mind.
On the seventh day, when the king was merry with wine, he commanded Muhlman.
Oh, sorry. There's seven of them. You can skip to the word seven eunuchs.
The seven eunuchs who attended him to bring Queen Vishta before the king, wearing the royal crown in order to show the peoples and the officials her beauty, for she was fair to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command conveyed by the eunuchs. At this, the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him.
The first sign that all is not well in Persia and Media. When the king was merry with wine, Proverbs 31:4, wine is not for kings, so this is bad. This is bad that he's merry with wine. He made a bad decision. Summoned his queen, who seems to have a spine, surprise, surprise, to come wearing the royal crown in order to show the peoples and officials her beauty. There's lots of speculation, actually, as to why this would have been a request that she would have refused. People have made her out to be a sort of feminist, you know, like, no, I will not do that. There's also speculation that maybe he asked her to come forward wearing only the royal crown. It's so specific, sort of saying wearing the royal crown. That maybe, and for a variety of reasons, she might not have wanted to do that. In any case, she refuses. The king becomes enraged. And we get our first real setup for the narrative that's going to introduce the woman who gives this book its title. Somebody who's brave enough to have another run of seven names, if you could give us verses 13, 14, and 15.
Then the king consulted the sages who knew the laws, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and custom. And those next to him were Karshana, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marsena, and Memcon, the seven officials of Persia and Media, who had access to the king and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs?
So, not to be heavy-handed or anything, this is satire. A sort of personal conflict has become a state conflict. He asked his wife to do something, she said no, and okay, so what is the punishment according to the law? Let me get my seven wisest men and have them read it out to me. Okay, human interaction is hard, but, the sort of, okay, let's resort to an edict rather than having tea and talking it out and renewing relationships is, I mean, this is supposed to be funny. This guy's being kind of a goofball.
Seven eunuchs and then seven advisors.
Right. Seven eunuchs to bring her, and they can't. And then seven advisors to advise the king. And let's see what kind of success they have. Let's get a big chunk of text again. Somebody brave. 16 through 20.
Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only has Queen Vashti done wrong to the king, but also to all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come home.
Sweet!
This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media who have heard the queen's behavior will rebel against the king's officials, and there will be no end of contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and to let the king give her royal position to another, who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low.
rest is history.
Happens in verse 16 that is not preserved in the English, but it's in the Hebrew. The Hebrew gives us two hints that something really stupid is coming up. And one of them is that the person who's speaking is Memucan, who is the last of the list of seven advisors to be named. So it's the dumb one.
It's Gilligan.
Right, right.
Gilligan's too.
So, you know, sort of the low man on the totem pole looking to make a name for himself. And that just, so that goes as you can expect. The other hint that the Hebrew gives us, his name is misspelled in verse 16, but the spelling of his name actually changes. You would pronounce it instead of Memucan, sort of a vowel gets shortened here and lengthened there, and it's sort of more like Mooncane instead of Memucan. And what that does, actually, I mean, Memucan, the initial me is sort of just from, it's a preposition, and Mucan comes from the word for destruction. So this guy never had a good beginning. But what his name means now, if you change it to Memucan, is a blemish is here. So if you can, I mean, however you feel about the law that has been passed here, the narrator has some particular feelings about it. It was passed by somebody we should absolutely not take seriously. But still, it is an interesting bit of foreshadowing. If you caught that phrase in verse 19, so that it may not be altered. This is going to be an important device for the rest of this plot, that laws that the king passes may not be altered. This happens in Daniel too, right? This is how Daniel gets caught out, because some people want him to get caught out, so they convince the king to pass a law about only praying to the king, and Daniel, you know, does not pray to the king, he prays to the God of Israel. And once he's caught, the law can't be controverted. He has to undergo the punishment of being thrown to the lion's den, and some of you might know how that story turns out. But this idea of laws not being able to be altered is going to happen in this book too. It's going to be really important for the Jews and for their enemies. Okay, so a bit of foreshadowing there, and that's always fun. Let's wrap up this chapter, verses 21 and 22.
The king and his nobles were pleased with his advice, so the king did as Memucan had proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his household, using his own native tongue.
So the message says, every man is master of his own house, whatever he says goes.
It's a really important thing for a king to be busying himself with, isn't it? I mean, again, if you haven't picked it up already, this is just sort of silliness that's going on here. I mean, how do you sort of pass a law like that and retain the respect of your subjects? Anyway, making fun of Persians is a time-honored tradition in Hebrew and Greek literature, and so we should not be surprised that it's going on here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The disturbing thing,
yes,
of course, it seems to me, is thinking about now and trying to understand some of these laws that say, well, if you're a Christian and you're not a Muslim, you're going to get stoned if you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's just happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, supposedly that got changed a little bit, and it's all in the same area. It's sort of like there's some laws that wherever in this world that it's like, what?
Sure.
Know?
Yeah.
Or like, and it has to do with men and women oftentimes,
mm-hmm,
and the roles or where the positions are, and so like it's like, well, here it is,
right?
And it's still
right
here.
And
it's
still
here.
Yeah. It's I mean, I've tried to, you know, and I've been as pedantic about it as any German, to underline the humor. There's humor going on here, but it's never really separated from the horror of what's going on in this narrative. And it only gets worse with further laws being promulgated.
Right.
And I don't ultimately know what to tell you to think about that.
Right.
The fact that it does still happen. There are still laws that are absolutely inexplicable and result in unspeakable horror.
Women can't go to school. Women can't go to
school. Yes, please.
I don't know if people heard that today the Supreme Court of the U.S. passed a law that CEOs of companies can now determine healthcare choices for women in terms of it's no longer between the woman and her doctor, that the CEO of the company she works for can now make those decisions. So it's an anti-
Oh, golly.
Today.
So.
Is that state or federal?
Yes.
Federal.
That's
federal.
Federal.
It's the Hobby Lobby.
It's the Hobby Lobby.
Oh, my gosh. The companies that are held
it's
privately.
It's a privately held company. So
yes.
It is
right.
Narrow.
It was much more narrow.
They're hoping that it's narrow.
However, the footnote in the Lutheran Bible here is this. What pleases the king is not always wise or good.
I was sitting here racking my brain. How am I going to bring this back?
Yeah,
and that kind of does it. Yeah. No. I mean, another thing that sort of runs through my mind reading this chapter is it seems to echo the Book of Judges from the everybody drinking as much as he pleased during the party to promulgating a law like this. The constant refrain in the Book of Judges, what I'm referring to, is everybody doing what was right in their own eyes, which, I mean, does sort of speak to exactly that footnote that you very helpfully found. You can stay. what is right in the eyes of a world that, especially a world that is not looking at God or not looking rightly at God, is not always right. And sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's funny and horrifying, and sometimes it is just horrifying. I mean, I think Esther is a book that helps us put those together very well, but also one that names the spaces where they're separate. Some things are just funny and some things are just horrifying. If we get through chapter 2, which I think we will, if we move really fast, we'll get to some stuff that's just plain funny. If somebody could read just verse 1, there's a short note that I want to make about that.
Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her.
The verb there for remember. Yeah, it's a slightly different translation. We've got the easier to pronounce name with two X's instead of lots of H's and S's. That verb, though, for remember is zakar. And this is how God actually remembers creation a lot of times, with a sort of compassion. Very, very popular verb. And there's the emperor doing it, remembering maybe with a bit of remorse the silly thing that he did. All right, verses 2-4, please. Daryl, actually, if you want to continue, you're doing great.
And the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them.
Then
let the young woman be, who pleases the king, be queen instead of Vashti. this advice appealed to the king.
There's no way around
it. I don't think I need to comment on that. An interesting thing about verse 5. So Esther, I didn't mention this. I probably should have at the beginning. Esther is one of the five scrolls that's attached to a Jewish festival throughout the year. This one is attached to a festival that we're going to get to. The whole book sort of exists to introduce this festival and why it's still celebrated. It's called Purim. So it's a special book. It's sort of read aloud in total. During the time of the year when Purim falls, to celebrate and observe that festival. Now, part of this reading aloud is there are four redemption verses that the entire congregation will read together, mostly to keep the kids awake, but also to sort of participate in the reading. And the first one is chapter 2, verse 5. So I realize this is going to be discordant because we all have different versions in front of us, but that's part of the fun anyway. If everybody, let's just go ahead and do verse 5 together.
Now there was a Jew in the citadel of Susa, whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamin.
Kish.
Just verse 5. We met our hero, yay, Mordecai. Whose name was Mordecai is actually a really important rhythm in the Old Testament. I'm told it's a rule that if you have a good guy being introduced, you get his, and his name was, the word name precedes the name. And if you have a bad guy, it's the other way around. Goliath was his name, or something like that. This is just a pattern on Exodus 6:2 when we get the divine name, when God says to Moses, my name is. So when God says it, his name, the word name comes first. So whenever we have a good guy like Mordecai introduced, whose name was Mordecai? Get the solemn. Anyway, so we know he's going to be a hero. We also know, and this is going to be very important for our discussion tomorrow, so maybe I'll go ahead and wrap up here and we'll begin in this place tomorrow, because our theme is going to be the redemption tales of Israel. And we just met our hero, and he is Israel through and through. He is a descendant of King Saul, who was some good and some bad. But he was also from the tribe of Benjamin. His father's name was Kish. He had a descendant called Shimei. All of these names are sort of popping and echoing in the history of Israel. So what a descendant of Saul, a Jew whose name was Mordecai, is going to do in this story is going to be very, very important for us come tomorrow. When we begin to look at not just how Esther tells the story of all creation and the world that both hides and reveals God's presence, but a story that hides and reveals the God of Israel's presence, a story that is in the redemption narrative of the nation of Israel. So that's tomorrow, and we're at 4:45, so... thank you very much for your attention and participation, especially my readers and especially the funny ones. If you have questions, I'll hang out. I like talking about Esther and some interesting stuff to get raised. But otherwise, I'll see you at social and dinner stuff tonight. Thanks.